Welcome to Because the Beatles, the podcast about the Beatles, everything about the Beatles, 24/7. I'm Erica.
And I'm Allison. And before we start, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or stream us on Spotify or find us on YouTube. And if you're enjoying BC the Beatles, feel free to leave us a preferably 5-star review so other Beatlemaniacs can find us.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter/X, and TikTok. We'll be posting videos, photos, and more from this episode and beyond. And you can also email us at bcthebeatles@gmail.com. And we have a great guest today. We are so excited to welcome back Sarah Schmidt to the pod. Sarah was last with us in 2021 to chat about the Apple Scruffs. That was just when Lizzie Bravo had passed away, if you recall. And back then, she was working on a new book about the U.S. and Canadian fan clubs, and we had promised that we would have her back once that book was out.
Yeah, and well, guess what? The book is out now, And it's called Dear Beatle People, The Story of the Beatles' North American Fan Clubs, and it tells the story of both the official and unofficial fan clubs around the U.S. and Canada. And with over 100 photos and rare historical documents like fan club membership cards and letters, this book gives new insights into that engine that fueled North American Beatlemania.
You may also know Sarah as the founder and editor of the incredible website Meet the Beatles for Real, a treasure trove of memories and photographs from fans that have met one or more of the Beatles in person. She's also the author of the book Happiness is Seeing the Beatles, Beatlemania in St. Louis, and is a contributing author to A is for Apple, Volumes 2 and 3. She's also given presentations at Beatles conventions and festivals around the U.S. and was sitting right next to me at Fest last month for the Women's History of the Beatles panel. So welcome back to BC the Beatles, Sarah.
Yay, Sarah.
Thank you for having me. It's so great to be with you, Erica and Allison, because, you know, BC the Beatles is one of my top favorite Beatles podcasts.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. And this book was one of our top books of recent times. This was an incredible story. So many amazing firsthand accounts of fan clubs. So cool. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, as you mentioned, I run the site Meet the Beatles for Real, which this week will be 15 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Crazy to me because it doesn't feel like it's been 15 years, but 15 years I've been collecting photos and stories of fans who met the Beatles in person. And one of the things that kept coming up over and over was that they met them because of Beatles USA LTD or the official Beatles fan club. And so I wanted to just, for my site, do a little background search about the Beatles fan club in the United States. And I couldn't find anything. And I was like, why is there not a book written about the Beatles fan clubs? Well, there should be. So I decided to be the person to write it.
That's amazing that you saw a niche and wanted to fill it, because that's the name of the game sometimes in Beatle world.
And my first idea was to write just a book generically about all Beatles fan clubs around the world. But then I quickly discovered that the US fan club and the UK fan club were two completely different entities and they needed to be separated.
They seem so. I mean, they have a relationship. It seems like the information comes to the North American fan clubs, at least the official ones, from the UK Home Office, but it's certainly not a one-to-one ratio.
Not at all.
There are so many fascinating stories in your book. You hear in the voice of a lot of the fans who were there, like you said, who got to meet the Beatles. What was the process like gathering that? I imagine it was, like you say, 15 years of Meet the Beatles for Real. Was it the bulk of the interviews, or did you seek out even more people to talk to for the book?
I had to seek out a lot of people. That was the most challenging part, but it was also the most fun because I made friends with everybody I ended up meeting through the process. But I had to be a detective. I used a lot of whitepages.com and found people's actual home addresses and handwrote letters.
Wow.
This is mostly unmarried women at the time, and most of those women probably changed their names, so it must have been double detective work.
Yes. The few men that I found very quickly, because their names never changed.
Right.
But the ladies, they were very much harder to find.
They must have been so excited to talk about this part of their life.
I would say 99% of them were. There was a few that were like, I don't remember anything about it. I'm not interested. And it was like, okay. but that was few and far between. Most of them were excited. And a lot of them said no one had ever asked them about how they met the Beatles before. So the stories in the book are brand new because these people have never shared that story before.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine like having a parent who met the Beatles and you don't know the story, or they mentioned it in passing and you didn't ask more questions? I would be like, tell me that story every day.
I've ran into that on my website on Meet the Beatles for Real. I've had at least one that really stood out, that someone's mother had passed away. And she, now that her mother had gone, she wanted to know the story. Like, Mom always used to say she met the Beatles. And I was like, yeah, whatever, Mom. I never listened to the story. And she wanted to know if I knew more than what was posted there, if I had any other pictures of her mom with the Beatles.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
I mean, I thought it was kind of sweet, but sad at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, when she was alive, your mom was trying to tell you all about it, and you blew her off.
And now we want to know, too.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
I thought the book was really interesting, too, especially because you and I had just been on that panel about women's history of the Beatles. And to me, this feels like a natural extension of a book like that, sort of introducing the concepts of the fact that a lot of women's experiences did not get recorded.
Those ladies, they were young girls, young teenage girls. They were the first Beatles historians.
Yeah.
Because they were keeping track of every little thing the Beatles did, writing it down in their journals, keeping scrapbooks. And that's the stuff that people are looking for now, to get the exact dates and times and what was happening on certain days in Beatles history.
I was surprised at the newsletters and the original documents at just how accurate they seemed.
And it was surprisingly up to the minute. I love the story about the girl who wrote to George in India, and he actually wrote back, because I'm like thinking in the late 60s, you know, how fast that information would have to travel for her to be like, okay, George is in India right now, I'm going to write him a letter, and then he's going to, you know, he'll get that right back. And there was no, where in the world is George Harrison? You know, should I send it to his mother and have her pass along? It was like, no, I know for a fact right now he's in India.
Yeah. And even for things like the Paul is Dead rumor, that people were able to convene, you know, a couple of hundred fans to try and quash the rumor.
They had like this underground phone communication thing going, with long distance phone calls late at night when the rates were the cheapest. News in Beatleland spread fast.
So, okay, let's start at the beginning with the fan club. So what was the process of starting the club, or having the idea to start the club, to getting, say, if you wanted to get your club officially chartered?
Okay, so the official Beatles fan club in 1964 was called Beatles USA LTD. There's all sorts of stuff floating out there that has that logo on there, Beatles USA LTD, with USA in parentheses. It didn't start until March of 1964, like a full month and a half after the Beatles came to America, the official fan club started. So that's part of the problem with the fan club to begin with, is it started late. But if you had started a fan club and you wanted to get an official charter, you had to have at least 25 members. You had to send their names in, and each one of them had to send in their $2 to join the official club. So if you had their names and it was marked that those members had the money sent in, then you got a charter sent back to you. Now, if you had less than 25, you could be a junior charter club, but not very many people did that one.
Did they just get less?
They got the same thing, just their charter said junior charter instead of charter.
It's all in the terminology. And then there were also people who had independent clubs, right?
Those were the ones I would have joined.
Some of those had some great names.
They were the ones that had fun and had all the parties and were like hardcore serious with their newsletters and everything. But yeah, most of them were just unhappy with the way the official club was being run, because they weren't getting their mail. You know, they would send off for stuff. They wouldn't get anything because it was unorganized over there. And they just thought they could run a fan club better. And really, they did. These young girls did an amazing job running the independent fan clubs.
And that's the thing, you know, I just kept thinking about it over and over as I was reading your book. It's like amazing how many fan clubs were initiated by the fans themselves, in a lot of cases, you know, young teen girls. And it just kind of goes to show that no one's more motivated than, you know, like a 12-year-old who loves a music group. And that's how it's always been.
Yep. And I know I find it amazing too how they would fundraise for different charities.
Yeah.
They'd fundraise to get a mimeograph machine for their club. Like, they were just really innovative with the way they would raise money for things and how they would approach the press and how professional a group of like girls under the age of 16 could be.
Right. They were fearless. They walked into rooms with adults, with mostly adult men, in situations that teenage girls in, you know, 1964 probably were not primed to experience. And they just went ahead and they did it and they were successful.
I love the group, the Ringo for President Club from San Francisco in 1964, that they marched to talk to the mayor or somebody at City Hall. And they're like, well, you can't talk to him. And they're like, fine, we're going to jump in the fountain. And they did.
Yes. Good for
them.
They
jumped in the fountain with their Ringo for President fan club posters and signs. And yeah, they really showed them.
Hey, it's an election year. Maybe we can bring that one back.
Yeah, I'm all for it. Peace and love ticket. I'm for it.
Hell
yeah.
Oh
my gosh. Yes, I love that idea. I also respected, Sarah, you and I, from being Midwestern girls. You know, certainly, of course, girls from New York or LA or big cities were particularly fearless, but I was proud of our little, I saw some Ohio girls in there getting it done. So
there
I was,
I
had a little pride in that.
I know, all over the country, you know, there was during the Beatle burnings in 1966, after John's Jesus statement, there was that one little group in the South that were singing Yellow Submarine across the street from where people were burning Beatles records.
That's amazing. That level of protest.
I know. And I loved also with the Beatle burnings, I think it's a group from like New Jersey or something that had an emergency phone call of all the members to decide if they supported John or not. And it was unanimously decided that they did.
I liked that one. And I liked when they had when I think it was in Chicago, they had an emergency meeting when Ringo and Maureen got married. Like, what are we going to do now? Ringo got married to Maureen. But they ultimately decided they were all for it and they liked Maureen. At the end of the day, they decided that it was okay. But one girl wasn't sure if it was going to change his drumming.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
that's a funny quote.
You got to find stuff to worry about.
Yeah, exactly. So if I was a teenager in 1964, how would I know which club to choose? How would I find out about these?
Well, you would have found out about the official fan club because there was a lot of advertising in newspapers. The LTD had little ads in different places when it first started out. And so some grown up in your life might have pointed that out to you, that like, here's the address to join the Beatles fan club. They also advertised in 16 in the teen magazines. If you wanted to join an independent club, there might have been one at your school. You know, you might have had a friend or somebody at your school that had started one. Or there was the pen pal and club section in 16. Occasionally, they would have a Beatles fan club listed. So if you wanted like one that wasn't near you, but focused just on George Harrison, you could join the George Harrison fan club.
So much choice. You could even join the Louise Harrison fan club. I loved it that we have a couple of these offshoots. We have Cynthia Lennon. We have Brian, Victor Spinetti, of course.
Maureen had a fan club. The idea was if you couldn't meet the actual Beatles, you wanted to somehow get a club for someone close to them, because maybe you could sneak in and meet them that way.
I loved the Patty Boyd fan club name, the Potty Bird fan club.
Yeah, the Potty Birds. Yeah, that was a cute one. How about the Maureen Starkey fan club, the Flying Cow?
Oh, yes. So good.
I don't know. That might be one of my favorite names. I can't decide. I go back and forth between quite a few of them, but that one's a good one.
And that one was named for the pub, right, that Ringo and Maureen had in their house?
Yes, because at first when I read that, I was like, are they insulting this woman?
I know.
Like, what is this? And then as I researched a little more, I was like, oh, yeah. In Sunny Heights, they had this little pub. They talk about it in the Maureen Cleave interview with Ringo, that he says, you know, he has this pub, the Flying Cow, that him and his wife have down in their basement.
So funny.
The time when they had named that, that article would have just been in Datebook, like right around that same time. So it would have been an in-joke.
I felt really sad for Cynthia, though, because when she and John got divorced, the first reaction was to disband her fan club. I understand like why they did. They probably just didn't want her to feel bad because, you know, it's linked to John and everything. But after you tell the story, somebody actually goes to Cynthia and says that she was very, very disappointed, very sad that her fan club closed.
Yeah, that whole Cynthia and John divorce got ugly among some of the fan clubs because some of the girls were blaming Cynthia because why would John cheat on her? Cynthia must have done something wrong. Mm. And then other fans are like, no, John's just a jerk. And like, how could you say that? He's John. It got pretty dicey there. But yeah, then the girl that was running the Cynthia fan club, she decided to end it because she didn't know how she was going to get news about Cynthia anymore.
Mm.
Which is a good point. How, mm-hmm. you know, she's no longer in the spotlight.
So what do you think was messier, though, Sarah? John and Cynthia's divorce or Paul and Linda's marriage? Because that was pretty savage. There's a lot of savage shit that happened.
That was one of my biggest shockers, is I thought Yoko was going to be a bigger deal than what she was to the fan club members. Now, Yoko did get ugly there for a while, and that one girl called her Miss Hiroshima, which I thought, ouch.
Yeah, that was gross.
Called her an animal. I mean, it was just, but really it was just like one or two people. And then it was like Yoko fizzled out. The fans just thought she was weird, but they didn't see her like as a threat to the band. I don't know how the Paul McCartney Love and Stuff fan club stayed together because they were really split about Linda.
Yeah, that's tough. And Linda let it get to her in those exchanges that you report.
Yes, she did. I think Linda was painting all the fans with this wide brush because so many fans in England were stealing from them and setting the mail on fire and sticking it through the hole in the door and just writing all these terrible things and chalk on Cavendish on the door. And I think to Linda, the fans were like, it's us against them, Paul, you know, like all the fans are mean.
Yeah. I mean, if you have American slut go home written on your driveway, and you're newly married, you probably are just have a knee-jerk reaction to anybody who identifies as a fan after that.
Linda eventually in the 70s changed her tune with the fans, but during the recording of Ram, it was pretty ugly.
Yeah, and she had just seen Paul go through something awful too. I think part of it was probably a protective instinct on her part to keep Beatle things away from Paul.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. I didn't think about that, but yeah.
I'm always a stand for Linda. I'll find all the excuses.
Yeah. I have no problems with Linda. It was hard talking to some of these ladies today because they still seriously dislike Linda because of the things that she did personally to them in 1970 or 71.
Which is totally understandable.
Which yeah. I get that. I mean, you can only judge somebody by the way they treated you personally. Like, this is what I know of them, and this is what she said to me. I never saw any other side of her. I mean, I get it, but you know, I just love Linda so much. I wouldn't be like, no, that can't be right.
Yeah. Like the encounter outside of a recording studio in New York that you talk about where,
yeah.
you know, Paul and Linda are coming in and out and she has no nice things to say to the, just a few girls, you know, standing outside waiting for them. And she gets into it with them and they tell her, like, we're not like those fans. We're American fans. We're not the ones that berate you at your home.
But, you know, the girls weren't that nice. They weren't that nice saying it like, oh, no. You know, they were kind of screaming it back at her because she was yelling at them. I mean,
then she said something snarky about the fan clubs, though. And that was
she
like,
did. She's like, said something like, well, this isn't a fan club meeting. You need to go home or something.
Yeah.
Paul and Linda had crossed the street and was walking down the street. And this group of girls, they weren't really following him. They needed to go that same direction. And Linda turned around and like screamed at him, stop following us.
Linda was on her last nerve. And I think it was in some cases misdirected anger just at the category of people called fans.
So that's how I interpret it. But reading all of the articles that I read in the fan club newsletters about it happening in real time, it was quite a division amongst those girls.
I'm sure it would be a horrifying experience.
Yeah. And then there was the girls that loved Linda, thought she was wonderful, versus the ones who was like, well, you've never met her and she's mean.
Ugh, very contentious.
And I'm reading these letters back and forth. And today it would have been like a Twitter war between these girls. But instead, it had to be like these newsletters that were like a month apart. But these kids are like, young adults. They're 19, 20 years old. They think they know everything. You know, they're at that part in life.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty catty.
You know, for the record, in the early aughts, I, through my Beatles website I had at that time, my fan site, I had a little fan club type deal called We Love Linda, because I don't know why I decided that people didn't like her at that point. I don't think that was true, but I decided, you know, I'm going to start this. I made like a little logo and you could like sign up on my website. I think I put your name on there. So I did my part in the Linda stanning.
Why did I not know about that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it was very early. It was an Angel Fire situation.
I was so active at that time online with Beatles stuff. That
yeah, no, it was.
I would have been all about it if I knew.
It was pretty small. I mean, obviously my site wasn't like a viral site, but we would also tape, like literally scotch tape, pictures of Paul and Linda to our t-shirts and wear those.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But see, that's the kind of shit that like young girls get into because they feel so passionate about what they love. And that's why the fan clubs were so cool and so different and why they're so active. I think it's just because that's the age where you're just in love with your interests. And that's what's so I mean, it was fun to relive that part of my life through the book, reading, you know, all these different experiences. But I think any Beatles fan can relate to what these girls did. And it made my heart happy. Just reading all this stuff, because it's like, oh, I remember when I heard that record, or like when my friends and I would come over, or they would come over to my house and we'd listen to a John Lennon solo album that we hadn't heard before, or, you know, so it's like a little bit different that we had the whole catalog to play with, but the excitement's still there. I just love that.
I like the story about the first Beatle fan convention in 1968, because the things that they did, they're similar to what we do now, just a little different.
Except they included a Brian seance, which maybe we should bring that back.
Maybe we should bring that back. Just for
I don't
Allison.
Know, guys. No, Allison's saying no. No,
oh,
no, that's too
okay.
Weird. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe after I have like a, you know, like a margarita, I'll be able to break out the Ouija board.
That's what they did. And it freaked some people out. But the other things they did besides that, or what we do today. I loved how they had the transistor radio and they all got to hear Hey Jude and Revolution at the same time.
Oh my God.
Like
that's
for
so
the
cute.
First time ever.
That.
They never heard Hey Jude before. And here they were, this group of like 25 girls at a hotel with a little transistor radio.
Can you imagine?
Like that just warms my heart to think about.
It gives me chills.
Yeah.
You know,
like here they were having a Beatles convention and a brand new Beatles song comes out and it's Hey Jude.
Wow. Well, speaking of conventions, I love the story. You talk about a couple of different types of gatherings. You know, you had the rallies, and, yep. But I particularly liked hearing about the balls with the Detroit DJ, I think.
Oh, the Detroit DJ, the guy that ripped people off?
He was like a con man?
Clay. His last name was Clay.
Clay. That's right. But I love the idea that anybody would be like have an auditorium filled with kids because they couldn't dance. So there was like no music, but he just sort of like did a slideshow of like his trip to London and showed them like, this is John's boot that he gave me. And it was just like oohing and aahing over that. Just
yes.
Mental picture is hilarious.
Yeah. And I talked to someone, Dee Elias, who wrote a really great book.
Oh, yeah.
But she went to those.
Oh, my God.
So I got to talk to her about what was it like. And she said, oh, it was just so exciting. Every time he took out like a cigarette butt and said, George smoked the cigarette, we all were just on the edge of our seats.
Yeah, the number of used cigarette butts that appeared at this book was surprising to me.
Yes.
I mean, any number more than zero would probably surprise me, but it kept showing up.
Well, you know, it's an easy thing to grab off a table after a press conference or they flicked it on the ground.
Now, I want to call out one club that I noticed a brief mention of. The Glendale Senior Citizens Fan Club. Not all of them were teenagers, I guess. I mean, I don't know if they considered senior citizens in this group like 30.
I was going to say, I think we'd all be in that club.
Yeah, I wasn't sure either because I couldn't find a whole lot of information. But just that they, I think they all got together to see Help.
Yeah, I think
they all got together and saw a Beatles movie. I also discovered, and I don't think I included it in the book because it wasn't a fan club, that in my own hometown, Alton, Illinois, there was an 86-year-old woman that went to see Help by herself. And like, she's like, they have this little picture of her in the newspaper. And she just all smiles, standing next to the Help poster. And she's like, I just think the Beatles are great.
We love her.
I know. Aww. I wish I could find out, like, whose grandma was that? Like, who? great grandma who's around this town now, just to be like, your relative was awesome.
Absolutely want to know. So I was wondering if you could talk about Bernice Young. She was the first person to run the official U.S. fan clubs, and she was a Black woman in her 30s, which I thought was really interesting. And she's not somebody whose name we know. I mean, Frida Kahlo obviously is known because of the documentary, but before that, she was mentioned by name. You know, she wasn't fake like Anne Collingham or something. Right. Was Bernice Young ever called out by name as somebody who she was and what she did? Or was she under the auspices of Feather or the other fake names on the American side?
Her name appeared on a lot of material, Bernice Young. But the face of the Beatles fan club in the United States was a young white woman instead of a 30-something Black woman. I never saw a picture of Bernice Young.
Wow.
I don't know what she looks like. I could find very, very little information about her. I actually found most information I learned about her because long after her Beatles connection, she wrote children's books about Black sports heroes like Jackie Robinson and Muhammad Ali. And in her little bio from these children's books, it told more about who she was. I mean, that's how I learned more about her life than I could on any Beatles things.
Oh my God, just a little footnote in her life.
Yeah, and it should have been a bigger deal. Like her name and her pictures should be known because she did so much for the Beatles fan club in the United States. And, you know, Brian really is the one that rallied for her because it had to go through him to hire her. And they're like, well, you know, she's a Negro woman. Do you want her to, you know, Brian, what do you think? And he was like, well, what do we care? Is she qualified? Does she have the qualifications for it? And he was like, well, if she's the best candidate, then yeah, that's who we want.
I love continually seeing the Beatles team on the right side of this history. Always.
I know. That warmed my heart. Although I do find it a little strange that she was in her 30s. But all the people I talked to that knew her only had wonderful things to say. And the word efficient kept coming up. Every time I spoke to someone, oh, Bernice was so efficient.
I don't know. As a 30-something myself, I think, hell, being a secretary, or not being a secretary, but running, you know, being in charge, the head of the Beatles fan club, sounds a hell of a lot more fun and interesting than a lot of other jobs. And I'm sure back then, too, with what women got to select from, being a secretary or a typist or receptionist or any other administrative position, you know?
Unfortunately, though, the fan club got too big too fast for Bernice. It really wasn't her fault that the fan club just wasn't keeping up with things. It was because they weren't hiring enough people to help her.
Right. It doesn't sound like she had the support that she needed from the home office to make it work.
Not at all. She was really one of the only paid employees of the fan club. And then she had some secretaries under her that were helping, that were paid. But everyone else were teenage volunteers that came after school.
Can you imagine thousands of fans writing to you like, where is my Christmas record? Why didn't we get anything this year? What's happening? And she can't do anything about it.
Well, yeah, she's behind in sending out membership cards to begin with. And then the mail's just getting more and more because she's getting letters of where's my membership card that's getting mixed in with everything else. Like, stop writing where's my membership card and I'll get you your membership card.
Yeah, it's like, I love how one of the volunteers was literally just there to sort the mail. That job alone must have been just such a hectic, you know, operation.
Right. The one gal, Laura, her only job was to open up the mail and see if there was any money in there for dues or someone was purchasing anything. I mean, that's what she was supposed to be looking for. Don't read the letter. Don't just see, do they have money in there? Because that's what we need. Like, if someone's ordered something, we need to get that out in the mail to them.
I will say it was ingenious. Whoever decided you need to put your membership number on the upper left-hand corner of the outside of an envelope if you write to us, because at least then we know you're a member and we'll respond to you faster.
Yes. But it took them like until 1967 to get that idea. They didn't get their act together until 1968. That was really when things started clicking. And by that time, the Beatles were almost over.
No one had ever run anything like this before, I would assume.
No, I mean, there were, of course, fan clubs before. And I think Elvis was one of the biggest ones. And Mickey Mouse was a big fan club.
Oh, right. Of course.
But yeah, nothing, especially for a group where there's four different people getting mail and then the whole group gets mail.
That's a lot.
And of course, everybody wanted to send Ringo a ring and everybody wanted to send, you know, each Beatle kind of had their own thing. People wanted to send them. So the fan club office was just full of stuff.
For our listeners, in the back of Sarah's book, there's a really cool little section that kind of gives you checklists of what you would receive as a fan club member for all the different sorts of clubs, which I, it was so much fun to read that.
Do you like
and I
that?
Want all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I want all of it. All
right. Well, I have to give credit to the illustrator of my book, Eric Cash. That was his idea. I didn't think it was needed, but he was like, no, people want
I
that.
I like it.
Because I had made that just for myself. I mean, it wasn't difficult to include it in the book. I was like, no, this is just for me, just so for my own collection. He's like, no, people want that. Put it in. So I did.
I think it's cool to see it all laid out.
Well, good. I'm glad that I took his advice.
All right. Thank you, Eric. And also, I loved his little doodles and the, yeah. You know, the upper pages.
No, aren't those so, it was those
really cute.
Turned out so cute.
Yeah.
He got that idea from the Hard Day's Night poster. Like, it has little girls on there. That was kind of his inspiration. And there's the fun pages inside. So is it supposed to be like a 16 magazine?
Yes, I loved all the 16. Because I collect teen magazines and have a mostly complete collection of 16s. But it was fun to see things that were familiar to me. It's like, oh, I know that, you know, Find the Differences page. I have that.
Yeah, well, he drew that.
He did?
Yes. It's not from the magazine at all. He drew that by hand.
That's wild. That fooled me. One of the things that I thought was really interesting that was like flying back and forth across all these fan clubs and from the home office over to the US were the amount of autographs and letters, even one word letters from the Beatles. And yes, I know not all the autographs are real, but I just think how funny that is that not only were the real Beatles autographs floating around, but, you know, you tell stories of the fan club presidents learning to like forge their names to send to their members. Which I never even thought of. I always thought it was just like Neil and Mal, but I never thought about the fan club presidents forging their names.
Especially in the early days. Later on, I don't think that happened as much, but in 63, 64, yeah, there were fan club presidents that were definitely learned how to sign their name like a Beatle.
Now you mentioned 1968, which seemed like both a turning point in efficiency, but also it seemed like the year when some of the wars began between the LTD and the independent clubs. And some of that sounded absolutely insane.
That was probably the story that got me to want to write a book about it more than anything else. Because as I started reading about it, I was like, I had no idea this happened. Why did I not know this? This is like crazy. So in 1968, in the fall, the official fan club kind of changed. So Bernice Young was no longer working for them. And they had a new director, Sandy Morse, who was a young 20-something white girl, Beatle fan. And they just decide they're going to redo the whole fan club. You know, there's been a lot of complaints. They weren't getting their stuff. They're going to redo it all. And one of their first things is to cease and desist all of the independent fan clubs so that there's only one Beatles fan club.
Now, was that a financial decision mostly?
The reason they gave is because these independent fan clubs, they felt weren't necessarily spreading the right information. They were telling, you know, we heard this rumor that this and this and this happened and the Beatles are breaking up or whatever. And they wanted a place where individual fan clubs could contact the main office and they would tell them the news to spread to the fans. So instead of, we heard this might be happening, like, this is a fact.
Mm.
That's what they said. I don't know. It might have been a financial thing. It might have been a copyright thing. No one really knows what was all behind it. I think really they wanted to take the model they were doing in the UK, which had been working since 1963, and have it work in the United States. And in the UK, they didn't have independent fan clubs. They had fan clubs that were all within the official Beatles fan club. And they had area secretaries. So they wanted to have state secretaries. Each state would have a Beatles secretary. that you would report to. If you were in Ohio, you would report to the, I believe her name was Bunny Racy, was the Ohio girl.
Amazing name.
The best name.
Bunny Racy. I wish I could have found her just because I liked her name.
Yeah.
And she seemed pretty spunky from all the letters I read that she wrote. So if you lived in Ohio and you had a question about when's the next Beatles album going to come out, you don't write the main office anymore. You're going to write Bunny, and Bunny is going to get a letter from the main office saying the new Beatles album will be out November 22nd. And then she can tell you. That's how they wanted it to run.
Basically just hiring middlemen or middlewomen.
But these independent fan clubs were getting in the way of all this happening because they had, you know, their underground phone and like, we think we saw George sneaking into Capitol Records last night. Like, you know, they were just whatever they thought was going on. And it wasn't always true, but, you know, it was fun. And there was 144 independent fan clubs around the country. Each of them got a cease and desist letter from the official Beatles fan club. And it said, the Beatles are embarrassed by your fan club, is one of the sentences in there.
That's horrible.
Ouch. That's awful.
I can't imagine getting this letter and thinking the Beatles are embarrassed. I mean, if you're 16 years old and you love the Beatles more than anything in the world, and you're being told that your club's embarrassing them. And the thing I discovered was that all 144 of these clubs got the exact same form letter. Nobody knew that. The way it was worded, it made it sound like it was written just to you.
Ugh.
Like when I told these ladies, here it is 60 years later, like, no, everybody got the same letter. What?
Oh my gosh. They found out about that just then when you told them. That's
that
wild.
It was a form letter that all 144 got. Because there's a sentence in there about, you are selling Beatles photographs without copyright permission. And the one girl said, I never sold Beatles photos. I didn't know what they were talking about. But that's because everybody got the same letter. Because most fan clubs were selling photos.
So 144 form letters. And of those clubs, 143 of them capitulated at the time?
Right? Not right away. Some of them broke up altogether. Some of them joined the official club like they were asked to do. Like it was either end your club or send the $2.50 because it went up 50 cents for all your members have to join our club and you'll be get a charter and be aligned with our club. So some did that. And then there were four that wouldn't do it at first. And then it got down to two, the George Harrison fan club and Father Lennon's Many Children. Those were the two clubs that wouldn't do it.
Which will always win for best name.
You know, I just met the gal that ran Father Lennon's Many Children. I met her in person Thursday night for the first time. And I felt like I was meeting a celebrity.
I can imagine.
Wow. I feel like you just met a celebrity.
I know. Like she's just a grandma. She's a sweet lady.
Well, that's Barb Fenwick, right?
Yes. And I was like, you're the hero of my book because your fan club would not bow down to the official cease and desist letter. So the George Harrison fan club did end up joining because Pat Kinzer got notice directly from George that he wanted there to join. I don't know if he really did, but she got word that George is asking you to please join the official fan club. And so, you know, if George is going to ask you, you do it, right? What else is she going to do? So she joined, but Barb and Father Lennon's Many Children wouldn't join it because she didn't think she had. She asked a lawyer and they were like, you don't have to do that. So she ended up polling her members. Like, well, do you want to join the official club or do you want to stay independent? And that made Sandy Moore so mad. Like, they don't have a choice. You just have to join it or end your club. This isn't a choice.
His correspondence was savage.
The letters back and forth were just, like, looking back at it now, I think they were funny. But at the time, it would have been pretty serious stuff because they were vicious at each other.
But she remained independent, right? For a while.
She remained independent until she decided in 1971 to end that club. And then she started the right thing like 4 years later in 73 or 74.
She's pretty famous in this corner of the world, I think.
She is. She had a bunch of, she had Father Lennon's Many Children, which then she changed the name to Beatles Rule because nobody was getting the joke and it was just causing her too much strife. So she changed the name to Beatles Rule, and then she broke that up and started The Right Thing in the 70s.
Another thing that I noticed in the book as we got toward 1970 was that the feeling of first generation fans versus younger fans was already well in place.
Oh, yeah. Older fans who had seen the Beatles in concert and were teenagers when the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan kind of had a possessive feel and didn't think that the younger fans who were in elementary school during Ed Sullivan and weren't old enough to see the Beatles in concert could ever quite understand and have love for the Beatles like they did. At the time, those younger fans were more hippies and more into peace and love, and they accepted Yoko without any problems, accepted Linda without any problems, because they didn't have that connection with Jane mm-hmm. or Cynthia to begin with. John's with Yoko, Paul's with Linda. That's just how it is. And I think the older fans didn't like that. Like, but wait, you don't hate Yoko and Linda? Like,
the sniping must have been partially a result of consolidating into the national clubs, right? Because if you had a million different options to join a Beatles fan club based on your sub-interests and your age, you wouldn't be fighting as much. You just joined the club you liked.
But a lot of younger people started their own clubs, like the Glass Apple chapter, which was mostly young people, and they were back to getting together in person and singing Beatles songs and just having fun. Whereas these older girls were working and in relationships and stuff, and it was all kind of through mail, and they weren't meeting in person as much. But then these younger people who were junior high, high school, they were getting together and singing Beatles songs and looking at magazines and finding Paula's Dead clues on albums and just having fun.
God, I would have loved to have been around in real time for Paula's Dead. I wouldn't have believed it, but I would have loved hunting for clues.
A lot of the people I talked to from there, I said, what was your thoughts about that? And they said, we didn't believe it, but we loved hunting for clues. It was so much fun to get together with a group of fan club members with our albums all laid out and like, well, what do you think this means? And they'll write down and look up stuff. Like, they said it was just a fun time.
It's like getting one of those solve a murder kits today.
Yeah.
And you do those with your friends at home.
I didn't talk to anyone that was like, oh, yes, we definitely believed it. No.
Oh, good.
But that was one of the activities that they liked to do at their fan club meetings, was look for Paula's Dead clues.
So fun.
I would have done that. I would have been all about it. I did read about people that were like sending sympathy cards to the fan club and flowers. And
oh, my God.
And then there's this interview with Sandy Morse, where she says that she has this real thick New York accent about the rumor about Paul being buried in a golden casket isn't true or something. I thought, well, I've never heard that one before.
They never stop.
No, because she was just getting inundated nonstop with phone calls at the fan club and she couldn't get any work done. So she gets on this radio station. It's like, stop it, everybody. It's not true. I just talked to Paul yesterday.
But the second you say something and you qualify it like he's not buried in a golden casket, oh, that just makes the conspiracy theorists like, oh, it wasn't gold. Maybe it was silver. Maybe it was platinum. It was definitely a casket.
Right. But she said he was buried.
Some of the other stories I loved in the book, Sarah, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, but the girls who actually, like, I loved all the stories of the American girls who traveled to the UK and got to meet the Beatles several times, some of them. And just how much respect the Beatles themselves showed for the fan club girls, you know, whether it was at a press conference on tour or it was like in a hotel room party situation, or if like they literally showed up at their houses.
Allison, this won't surprise you, but that all goes back to Brian.
They had good training.
He really told them, like, these fan club members, these people running your fan clubs around the countries, around the world, they're the ones buying your albums, promoting you for free. Like, they're not getting anything out of this. So anytime you meet a fan club member, you're supposed to treat them with utmost respect and kindness and do whatever you can to make them feel loved. And like, he really hit that home, because one of the girls that met him at a press conference, she goes, well, I'm with the fan club. And John goes, oh, you're with the fan club? Well, we have to be nice to you now or something. Something along those lines. Like,
of course he did.
Yeah, like, oh, because Brian was standing right there too. And he was like, oh, great. Well, you're one of those. You don't have a choice. You have to be nice to you now.
Wasn't that brilliant though on Brian's part? Like the way that the stories spread through the network, he just knew. You meet a Beatle is amazing to you. Everybody you know is going to know.
It goes in the newsletter.
Yeah, it was brilliant of him. And the Beatles, they really took that to heart, because even if you came knocking at their door and said, I'm with the fan club, they let him in.
That level of access is insane to me.
Oh, yeah.
Going back to Linda, like, I can see why this freaked her out, just having people come to your door.
Constantly knocking on your door, like, hi, is Paul home? And then Paul, half of the time at least, would be like, oh, I'm going to go out and talk to the girls outside. And Linda would be like, we're doing what?
Right? Even on the infamous Dirty Weekend, like, he said he talked to them for like 40 minutes, but Linda was inside.
Yeah, Linda and other people.
Well, yeah.
I couldn't believe that he sat on the steps of his bungalow and talked to girls during the Dirty Weekend. And I'm so jealous.
That one girl I talked to, Robin, she sat with him. She was like 11 or 12 years old. Her and her friend bought a peanut butter and jelly sandwich from the restaurant and split it, because that's all they could afford.
Oh my God.
While they were waiting for Paul. And one thing she remembers was that his belly button was hairy.
I loved that. I love that note.
That's such a fan club note to make in the newsletter article too.
Yes. It's so funny. Yes, for those of our listeners who don't know, I have like a crazy obsession with the Dirty Weekend, just because, well, it happened here in LA. It happened at the Beverly Hills Hotel. A lot of it is down to Paul's amazing red velvet coat. I'm obsessed with that. And just the whole story. It's a lot of things, but I was so delighted. Erica, as soon as she got to that part of the book, she just texted me, page 208. So that's the page that the Dirty Weekend's on, for anybody keeping score.
Well, you knew I had to include something about the Dirty Weekend in there, because it's one of my favorites as well.
I do. Well, Sarah, you gave me at Fest a couple of years ago, I think you gave me a photo of Paul in his Dirty Weekend red crushed velvet jacket. I still have that at my desk at work.
I love hearing that. And all those pictures were taken by little fan club members with their Instamatics.
I was impressed by the quality of some of those photos. Like, there is one of George, and I can't remember who took it, but it was later George when he had the long hair. And I'm like, I've seen that photograph in books or somewhere that I would have assumed it was taken by, you know, a quote unquote real photographer.
That was taken by Rusty Rand, who was the assistant director of the fan club. And yeah, she took a bunch of pictures that day and sold them through the official fan club with George with the long hair. Yeah, they're beautiful pictures.
Yeah.
She says she took 77 of them. I think I've only seen like 8. I want to see the rest now.
I always say it. More and more things come out. Basements, attics, look for them.
I was going to say, Rusty Rand's grandkids, go paw through your grandma's stuff. Find these negatives.
So officially, the Beatles fan clubs ended in 1972.
Yes.
But I'm sure that many, many unofficial versions sprouted up in their wake.
Oh, yeah. The official Beatles fan club, though, ended in January 1972, and there has never been an official sanctioned by Apple or the Beatles fan club since. Any other fan club that has happened since then has been unofficial.
Yeah, I guess the only other one I can think of was Club Sandwich, but Paul solo. So
right, that's the only other Beatle-esque fan club that has really happened was with Paul. And then I think he tried to have one a few years ago. So I have a little card. A plastic, like, ink card from, I don't know, like 2010.
Oh.
But it didn't last very long. But for the Beatles, there has not been an official fan club since 1972.
Yet to me, so many of the things that happened in these early fan club days, they were the roadmap for the fandom community we have now.
They are. What the fan clubs did back then is no different than what we do today. It's just we're different. Technology's different. But I see the same love and the same passion and the same camaraderie from the 60s and early 70s today.
Which is one of the reasons I love this book so much. It's not just a Beatles book. It's a book about us. It's a book about our beginnings, our history, and the people who made this amazing community that we have now.
What I that I say about it is, like, the Beatles are bit players in the book. They're not the main focus of the book. They're in there, but it's a book about the fans and the love of the Beatles and the way they express that love.
Yeah, I love that. And I love getting these stories down for the first time in the photos.
That was important to me, to get those stories down, especially when people started telling me, like, oh, I've never told anyone about the time I met the Beatles at their press conference. And I was like, you've never told anyone? Like, no, not since it happened. And I was like, why didn't you ever tell anyone? No one's ever came and asked. You're the first one to come and ask me.
Wow.
Well, you are doing the Lord's work.
I know. Thank goodness for you, Sarah.
I'm trying. I try to hit this really hard all the time. Everybody has a Beatles story, even if you never met one of them. You still have a Beatles story. And it's important for you to get your story down. If it's you saw Paul in concert or how you got to get into the Beatles, like, it's important part of the Beatles story is to, like, write down your story.
And they're all interesting. I've never heard a story about a person's personal history with the Beatles that I didn't find interesting.
I know. Even if you just started to like them because you watched Get Back, that's your story.
Yeah, and there's so many layers to that, too.
There is, and I just think it's so fascinating how everybody gets into the Beatles and how you decided who your favorite Beatle was, and all of that is just fascinating to me.
Yeah.
But especially if you did get to meet one of the Beatles, that's very important that you get it down, the date and how it happened.
Yes, and anybody listening who, maybe your mom, your dad, your grandma, grandpa, or maybe you met a Beatle at some point, there is a place where you could go to tell your story, right, Sarah?
There is. MeetTheBeatlesForReal.com. I collect all these stories because I think it's important for them to be historically collected.
Yes, please submit your story.
And you'd just be amazed how many connections people make through these stories. Like, someone will be like, wait, I was pen pals with her way back in the 60s, and they become friends again.
So cute.
I mean, just lots of really neat things like that happen.
Hmm.
Because the Beatles story is so much bigger than the four guys and the Beatles. It's all of us.
Yes.
And where else can people find you and your book?
My book is available on Amazon, and it just got released as an ebook.
Yay.
Like, within the past week.
Well, congratulations.
So you can go on Amazon. Thank you. And so it's available now as an ebook, a hardback, and a paperback.
Excellent.
Anywhere where books are sold.
Well, we had an amazing time reading it, and our listeners are going to absolutely go crazy over it.
Well, I hope so. I would love for more fans to have the opportunity to read it and to learn more about the fan club in the United States and in Canada. Yeah, and there's no other book about Beatles fan clubs out there, because I looked for them.
You are the originator.
Although there is one about the Beatles fan clubs in Japan, but it's all written in Japanese.
Well, that needs to get its English translation.
Yeah.
So, Japanese fans, you have a job to do. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for being here. This has been so much fun. We love having you on. Please come back anytime.
Thanks for asking me.
Always a joy to have you on. And congrats on the book again. I mean, congrats on everything you do. You've been such a busy little bee these past few years, and just coming out, churning out great work. So we're glad that you are so prolific in your research and all that you do.
Well, thank you. You know, I just do it because I love the Beatles.
Yeah, that's why a lot of us do what we do.
Right. It's as simple as that.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Well, thanks again, Sarah. And thank you to you for listening to BC the Beatles. And as always, subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening right now. And give us a rating/review so other Beatle maniacs can find us.
And follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter/X, and TikTok. We'll be posting photos and more from this episode and beyond. And you can always email us at bcthebeatles@gmail.com. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.